I love cops. Cops are the good guys. Most of them, the vast majority of them, are good guys who do good things, often at risk to their own lives. So it doesn't take much for me to bring a cop onto my show and to talk to him about, or her, about the important things that he or she does. I recently met one out at Montpelier, had a law enforcement seminar, and this one I immediately knew I had to have on the show because in addition to having a remarkable internet presence, which we'll get to in a few minutes, he has a remarkably sunny disposition despite having grown up in extremely difficult circumstances. It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week it's all about Dancing Deputy Diggs.
You're listening to your Weekly Constitutional, hosted by Professor Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at Lincoln Memorial University's Duncan School of Law in Knoxville, Tennessee. YWC is underwritten by the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier.
It doesn't happen to me very often. Perhaps it does to you. You meet somebody and you instantly feel a connection, a warm fuzzy, if you will. Well, that happened to me recently when I was out at Montpelier to teach a seminar on the Fourth Amendment to a bunch of cops. I love cops. Cops are great people, and I always enjoy speaking with them. But in this particular occasion, I was introduced with a song before I even knew Deontay Diggs' name. Deontay was singing a song that I had to join in with. We'll get to that later. In the meantime, I'll simply say that I spent much of that day getting to know Deontay. We had lunch together, and by the end of the day, I realized that we had to bring him into the studio for an interview because beyond his sunny disposition and his charming personality, there lies a story of tragedy and redemption that I think you will find poignant and uplifting.
My name is Deontay Diggs, and I'm a second lieutenant with the Stafford County Sheriff's Office in Stafford, Virginia. And I'm a watch commander assigned to the patrol division. So I oversee three rotations at the sheriff's office.
That sounds extremely important. You're a watch commander. I've never been a commander of anything. That's a really cool title. What does a watch commander do?
Basically, each shift, we have three shifts per rotation. So
8 hours a day.
11 and a half hours.
Whoa, wait. 8 times 3 is 24. How do you have 11-hour shifts, three of them a day? That's like 33 hours a day.
So what we do is we overlap a little bit. So we have day work evenings and midnights. Mm-hmm. And so I make sure that we have the appropriate manpower, that policies and procedures are being followed. And so my counterpart on the A side, we communicate and make sure that we're one sheriff's office, because when you have two different rotations, they don't get to work together that much. Sometimes we can get off a little bit. And so we make sure that we communicate and monitor what the deputies are doing each shift and that we're all on the same page.
That's something, a reminder that the rest of us need to remember, and that is that police are on 24/7, 365.
Yes.
I mean, you guys don't ever sleep as an institution. So you guys not only go 24 hours a day, but you have overlapping shifts to make sure that the public is protected all the time.
Definitely. Holidays, bad weather, it doesn't matter. We're out there and we're protecting the community.
You guys are out there. And as I said today, I love you guys. I think you're marvelous.
Well, thank you.
I think you're heroes. Glad to have you with us. That's how we met. We met here today at Montpelier during the law enforcement seminar.
Yes.
You have spent now 2 days in this seminar, and you must be tired of listening to people talk, which is among the reasons I wanted you here so you could talk yourself. But yeah. Have you had a good time?
I have had a wonderful time. It has been awesome. I would recommend it to law enforcement officers all across the nation. You really get stimulated when you get to listen, and we know how to be law enforcement officers, but this is teaching us the why behind what we do as law enforcement officers. And so you're looking at the Fourth Amendment and the search and seizures. And so it's so important. And as a lieutenant, I can take this back and share this with my shift supervisors. So I'm really enjoying it and having a blast.
I'm really glad to hear that, because that's why we have you here. Montpelier obviously cannot have everybody come in for on-site seminars, which I describe as the gold standard experience here. because it, by its very nature, it's a small number of people. It's an intimate experience. It's one-on-one to some extent. It's certainly small groups. So we try to choose groups that we think of as having leverage. For example, we'll occasionally have judges in. The entire Virginia Supreme Court has been here for a constitutional tune-up in the past. We have teachers, because obviously teachers go forth and share their knowledge with thousands or more students. And, of course, cops. Cops are the face of the Constitution, as we emphasize today. You guys have the badge. You have the gun. You are the people who really are the living embodiment of governmental power and therefore constitutional authority and constitutional limitation. So it's a fantastic opportunity for us to have you. And I've done several of these law enforcement seminars, and I will echo what you said. I think that anybody who's in law enforcement would benefit from this sort of thing. We don't come here and criticize law enforcement. We don't tell them all the bad things they've done. We simply try to help. Try to help and make sure that everything is done in the proper way. And you had a great group today, didn't you?
Yes, we definitely did.
It was really great fun. Everyone wanted to talk and share stories, and we had a great sense of humor. Nobody has a better sense of humor than a cop.
Oh, yeah. You know how that goes. You have to have a good sense of humor in this line of work. I mean, it's the emotional roller coaster, and you see, you know, really tragic and really bad things, and sometimes that sense of humor can get you through that. Mm-hmm. But then we have those positive experiences, and the sense of humor helps in that as well. So I will say that this is, in my career, in my short career time, this is the best training that I've had.
Really? I'm so pleased to hear that.
I just can't say enough about this training. I can't wait to get back. I've already texted my administration and told them how much I've enjoyed this training. It's so important. And I wish I would have had this earlier on in my career.
Yeah, I think that's actually something that I'm going to suggest to Doug and all the rest of the people here at the center that we try to do, is we try to hook up with people as quickly as possible, because you guys go out in the streets and you need to know what you're doing from day one. And you do. I mean, I'm not criticizing, yeah. But this is all very, very important stuff. So I agree with you. I agree with you completely. But of course, there were several people there. There were, we had about a dozen people at the seminar, maybe 15,
yes.
Something like
yeah.
that, at the seminar today, and really had a great discussion and great time with everybody. But of all those people, the reason I asked you is because you and I happened to sit down at lunch together. And we're sitting down at lunch with Jen Howell, the deputy director of the center, and we're having a really good time. And then somehow, someone mentioned something rather special about you, and I refer to you now as the Dancing Deputy Diggs.
Yes.
Tell everybody who's listening why I'm thinking of you now as Dancing Deputy Diggs.
Well, it's been said I'm known around the world as the Dancing Deputy. It started 2 years ago when the chiefs and the sheriffs in my area were asked to come out and support a drive for underprivileged kids or youth for school supplies. And mm-hmm. so the thought process was that they were going to get up and do lip syncing and dancing to get the
crowd. Police officers
in.
Were going to do
yes.
this.
And,
that
and,
is such a great idea.
And the chiefs and the sheriffs were like, absolutely not. We're not doing that. But
really?
We will send deputies to do that.
Oh, okay, place. Okay. Then we'll send the other guys.
Yeah,
to
we'll
okay.
send the other guys. We'll show up to support it, but we're not getting up there and doing that.
Mm-hmm.
So this year I did a dance to Beyonce's Formation.
For our older listeners, what is Beyonce's Formation? Is it one of her recent hits?
It's one of her recent hits, and I'm a Beyonce fan, so
she's an amazing talent.
She is. She uh-huh. is. And if you
and without sounding sexist, incredibly good looking.
Beautiful.
Absolutely. Okay. So go on, please.
And so if you go back a little bit, and this was not part of my decision, because when I did it the first time, I had chosen Single Ladies for Beyonce. So that mm-hmm. was the first time I ever did it. This year I did Formation. There was a little bit of controversy with the Formation song.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that kind of played.
Wait a minute. Why is that? I have to admit, I'm not familiar with Formation as a song.
Formation talks about, or in the music video, there was a display of the hands up.
Hands up, don't shoot.
Don't shoot.
So this was very much part of that whole controversy,
yes.
right?
And so people were saying that it was an anti-cop song.
Wow, that is a loaded song for
yes.
a cop to pick.
Yes. And so when I first heard that, and they were saying that Beyonce is anti-law enforcement and that type of thing, I was like, absolutely not. I've been following her career since she was part of Destiny's Child.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I went forward and did the song, that also started some conversation, like, why that song? And I said, well, I believe that she's talking about police brutality, and I think that's something that we should all talk about. There are law enforcement officers who have done things that are inappropriate or who have made mistakes. And as long as we're addressing those specific incidents, then that's okay. That's an okay conversation to have because we all want to do better.
I am so glad you said that because if you recall, I began our discussion today by talking about my enormous admiration for cops.
Yeah.
And I very much have that. But we have to admit that cops are people. And there are going to be a few bad apples, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, there are going to be some bad individual cops. There are going to be some bad departments who have bad leadership. Yeah. And unfortunately, a lot of that has a racial connotation. And a lot of that it exists in minority communities. And there's a breakdown in trust. And you know, the good cops need to speak up about that.
Absolutely.
And all of us do.
Yeah.
And always with the caveat that we believe that most cops are great. They're heroes. But that we have to address these issues, forthrightly. So very good for you.
Yeah. From there, I chose the song, not really with all of that in my mind at the time. I chose it because I knew it was a song that was going to interact with the kids and the youth that were there. And it went viral the first time that I did it.
I will say this was back last October, right?
So that was the second time it went viral. It went viral in August, which was the first time that
August
I did
of 2016.
It. Yeah.
And when we say viral, we mean viral with a capital V.
My daddy Alabama, mama Louisiana. You mix that Negro with that Creole, make a Texas Bama.
You know, sometimes it's too bad that this is a radio show because you didn't get to see Deontay dancing there. But it's easy. Just look up Dancing Deputy Diggs, D-I-G-G-S, on YouTube, and you'll come up with a bunch of videos. After the break, we will have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and speak some more with the Dancing Deputy.
If you hit it right, I might take him on a plane on my chopper. Drop him off at the mall, let him buy some J's, let him shop up. I might get your song played on the radio. I might get your song played on a radio station. Cause I slay. You just might be a black Bill Gates in the making. Cause I slay. I just might be a black Bill Gates in the making. I see it, I want it.
Well, it's that time again, that wonderful time here in the green upholstered confines of the small broadcast booth at the Potter Studios at Montpelier. It's time for the quizzes. I'm excited. And Doug, are you excited too?
I am always excited to be with you, Stuart Harris.
I am always excited to be with you as well, especially when we're going to do a quiz. Do we have a contestant for our quiz?
You do have a contestant. I'm George Casuto. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing very well, George. Where are you calling from?
Good. Well, I'm working up here in Loudoun County, Virginia, but I live in near Brunswick, Maryland.
Near Brunswick, Maryland. Okay. And,
right.
And I thank you for volunteering over Facebook. I encourage other people to like us on Facebook as well, and they can do this in the future. You said in your message that you're a civics teacher.
That's correct. Eighth grade civics.
Really? So what sort of stuff do you cover in eighth grade civics?
Wow. It's been a fun year with the election. It's been very interesting. But, you know, usual stuff like constitutional rights and three branches of government. And we do a little economics at the end of the year.
Sounds like George is an expert, Doug. So you'd have a really tough question for him.
I wish I had a question about economics.
Yeah, that would have been good.
Oh, boy.
But I don't.
Not my strength, to be honest with you, but go ahead.
Okay. Well, George, I have a question and I'm going to give you four choices. Are you ready?
Yes, ready.
How did the original delegates at the Constitutional Convention of 1787 get chosen? How did the original delegates at the Constitutional Convention of 1787 get chosen? Is it A, elected by their states, B, appointed by their state legislatures, C, by lottery on the second Tuesday in the previous November at the state's Capitol Square, or D, by invitation only from Ben Franklin?
Well, I'm going to, that's a tough one. The soundtrack of Hamilton is kind of going through my mind. So I honestly have to kind of take an educated guess. So I'm going to say B, appointed by their state legislatures.
So you think that you don't think they were elected by their state? You've narrowed it down to A and B, I take it.
I have narrowed down to A and B.
Those are the two tough choices. And what were they again, yeah. Doug, A and B?
A was elected by their states.
Okay.
And B was appointed.
Right. And I don't think there was a popular vote, you know, of the people at that point for delegate to the Constitutional Convention. So that's why I'm strongly leaning to B.
And B was appointed by their state legislatures.
Okay.
Right.
But you didn't like Ben Franklin.
Nope.
Okay. He's in Loudoun.
He's a good guy, but I don't think he had that much pull.
And you don't think they got together a year before and did a lottery in the public square?
That answer was just too convoluted to be right. So
okay. So it's down to A and B, and I don't think we're going to get George off of B. Doug, I'm looking at you.
George, you are correct. They were appointed by their state legislatures.
Yeah, right, yeah. Right.
And you hit on it
there's
exactly
a line
right.
in Hamilton. He says, I was chosen for the Constitutional Convention. So I kind of use that line in the play.
This is the first time that a line from Hamilton has been
that's
decisive
right.
in one of our constitutional quizzes.
Oh, there you go. Uh-huh.
Oh, that's marvelous.
Well, we should keep this just among ourselves since no one else was in the room when that happened.
That's right. In the room where I'm in an empty classroom. You're absolutely right. No one else was in the room. You're
all right. Well, George, thanks very much. Make sure you send us a message on Facebook with your T-shirt size and your mailing address, and we will put a T-shirt and a pocket constitution from James Madison's Montpelier in the mail to you.
That's great. I did a training down by you guys 1 year. It was great. Called We the People.
Did you really?
I did.
You were here at Montpelier?
At Montpelier. It was awesome.
You did it with
my girlfriend there, yeah.
Well, I'm not going to ask you all those personal questions. So you've been to Montpelier for We the People. That's marvelous, George.
Yes, it's beautiful.
Right. Make sure you come back sometime.
Will do. Thanks.
All right.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you, and thank you, Doug.
Okay.
You bet. Hey, it's the Constitution. I read it for the articles.
At the Constitutional Convention.
I was chosen for the Constitutional Convention.
There is a New York junior delegate.
Now what I'm gonna say may sound indelicate.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week my guest is Deontay Diggs. He's a sheriff's deputy in Virginia, and I met him recently at Montpelier when I was teaching a seminar for law enforcement officers, a seminar on the Fourth Amendment. I met Deontay right at the beginning of it when he greeted me with a song, and things just got better and better from there. Before the break, we were talking about a viral video of Deontay dancing to Beyonce's song Formation. If you haven't seen it, you need to get on and check out YouTube. But in the meantime, let's go back and speak about this viral phenomenon. How many hits have you gotten in these videos?
40 million hits in the United States. So,
I'm laughing out loud because I was so pleased that our downloads over the past 2 years have gone from 140,000 a year to 360,000 last year. And I was just so pleased with that. And then you came in with your 40 million hits and made me feel like a piker. So well done. Well done, sir.
No, it's been such a blessing. And from that.
And by the way, what do people need to Google to see this video? It's just simply Dancing Deputy?
Dancing Deputy. That is it.
That'll get it.
Dancing Deputy.
You'll find it on YouTube.
You'll find it on YouTube.
I actually Googled Dancing Deputy Diggs. D-I-G-G-S, because other dancing deputies are out there emulating you now, which
yes.
is a cool thing.
Yeah, it is kind of.
But if
cool.
they want to see the original, your last name is Diggs, and
yes.
so people can do that. Okay, so now, you did these videos back in August of 2016, and then in October of 2016.
And in October, I did it again at a pep
right.
rally.
At a pep rally, yeah. I like both of them. Very, very impressive. And in fact, I'll mention to people who haven't had a chance to see it yet that you end at least one of them with splits.
All of them.
All of them.
That's
was
my signature move.
Oh. How old are you?
31.
And you're still doing splits. I mean, this is pretty damn impressive. Excuse my French. I mean, just remarkable. Okay. Yeah. So everybody needs to go out and watch this. And what happened when you get a viral video of this sort?
Well, I've gotten to go on talk shows. I got to go to TD Jakes. I've done America's Got Talent. I've had everything from Time magazine to Business Insider and do stories and talk about my life, potentially a documentary and reality TV show in the near future.
Wow.
So a lot of things, a lot of blessings coming my way because of it. But I like to use my platform to help people. And to shine a light on people that are hurting in the community.
Let's pause there for just a moment, and let's mention, because this is radio, people can't see you. You're African-American.
Yes.
You're also openly gay.
Yes.
You are a police officer who wears his uniform when he's doing his dance move. He's out there busting moves and making the fans roar. So you are an extremely interesting person from a number of different perspectives. So you find yourself with this enormous fame all of a sudden, and you've decided that you want to use it to tell your story and do some good. And that's really what we talked about during lunch today.
Yes.
So please, start at the beginning. And first, start out with your name. How do you spell your name?
D-E-U-N-T-A-Y.
And you pronounce it?
Deontay.
Deontay. Okay. And so tell us your story, Deontay.
Yeah. I was born on the Eastern Shore of Maryland, and I was born into a single-parent home, and it was my mother, and I'm the oldest, and I don't have very fond memories of my childhood.
How many siblings do you have?
There's three of us all together, and I was kind of the father figure from a very young age, and so it was my job to really take care of my brothers. And
and three boys.
Three boys. Three boys, all boys. And so my mother was addicted to drugs, and she also was an alcoholic. And so that type of environment brings with it a lot of adversity. Growing up, I experienced everything from starvation to molestation, physical abuse.
Oh, good heavens. Well, let's take these one at a time.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. First of all, starvation. People can't see you again. I encourage them to see you. You're very muscular and very fit now. You look like a gymnast, if I may say.
Thank you.
So that's extraordinary. Molestation.
Yes.
And other abuse. Oh, definitely. My goodness. Well, let's start at the beginning. Tell us about this.
Yeah. So the first thing that I would say that was kind of off was the starvation piece of it. So, you know, there were times where we just didn't have food. We would always move from place to place to place. And so there were times that I can remember where I would go and steal dog food from the neighbor's house to feed myself and my brother.
You were eating dog food?
At times, yes.
Oh, man.
And so that was the hard part. And so as a kid growing up, education wasn't important to me.
Well, how could it be? You were hungry all the time.
Exactly.
I mean, all you were thinking about was your next meal, I'm guessing.
Next meal and where I was going to be safe at.
Yeah.
And so that was the, I would say, the first obstacle in life that I had to overcome. And so going to school or going to church, which became a big part of my life, was about eating and being safe.
That were at school lunch programs.
School lunch programs.
I'm guessing that was your only meal some days?
Yes.
Oh, man.
Yes,
you know, we hear a lot of this, and I don't want to get too much into policy, but we hear a lot about people being concerned about the amount of money being spent in school lunch programs or this or that aspect of them. But I've often heard it said that for many poor children, that is the only meal they get in a day.
And I get to go in, and part of my message when I go in to do motivational speaking, which I've started that business as well, is I get to talk to teachers and remind them that sometimes when these kids are acting out and they have negative behavior, it's because they know that they're going to go home and it's going to be, you know, traumatic experience. So they know that there's going to be issues when they go home. School is safe. They get that period of time, but then they have to go back to that. Or when the summertime comes and you start to see behavior, negative behavior, and it's escalating, it's because the anxiety of going back home and not being able to come back to school for the summer.
Isn't that remarkable? Most kids, at least from privileged backgrounds, look forward to school vacations.
Yeah.
And you're telling me the opposite, that school's the safe place and that these kids are dreading their breaks.
Definitely.
Well, I've heard it said. I lived in a place in rural Florida where there was a summer program that was basically designed to replace the lunch program at school. And that sometimes they would have both breakfast and lunch for these kids because that was the only food they got. And so to get back to you, that's, where were you growing up again? You said in
Eastern Shore, Maryland. Pocomoke City, Horntown, Chincoteague. My mother constantly moved because she didn't want social services finding us or family members and those types of things.
And you know, when you hear Eastern Shore, you think resort areas.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what I'm thinking. I'm thinking of guys, you know, living out there on these wonderful houses that I couldn't afford.
Yeah.
Or going out there to stay for a few days at the shore. And you're telling me that there was an underclass out there, a bunch of people who were kids going hungry.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And in some of the trailer parks that are out there as well. Mm-hmm. And so it's really unfortunate. And so when you look at cutting programs for children or for meals, it's if you've lived that experience, you know how bad that can hurt the community and hurt our youth. Because unfortunately, you don't ask to be born into that type of environment, and it's something that you have to deal with. And so you're looking for someone to help you and give you a hand up in the situation.
Did you find anybody to help you get past the dog food and into actually eating human food?
There were times. Uh-huh. There were times either where mom would find work or people in the, would be around family and things would be good. One of the things that we lived by at a young age was what happens in this house stays in this house. So we were forbidden to talk about these things until I was much older, and part of my coming to terms with what I had dealt with and helping other people was to say, this is what I experienced. And so a lot of things that my family at some point knew that things were bad, they just didn't know how bad it was. And so we had to keep that on the inside.
Well, I guess I understand being private. I understand being concerned about such things. But man, what an additional burden that was on you. Here you are starving, not being able to get enough food, eating dog food, and being told, well, don't tell anybody about this, people who might help you.
Yeah.
That's rough. Yeah. I'm guessing from what you're saying, Dad was not in the picture.
Never. That's one of the things, and I like to keep it real, so to speak. And
sure.
That's one of the things I still struggle with to this day, is that even with the fame and, you know, the celebrity and all that brings, I still don't know my biological father.
You've never met him?
Never met him. And
do you know who he is?
I don't know anything about him. All I know is I have a name on a birth certificate.
Oh, man.
And so before my mother passed.
Your mother's passed away.
October.
Just recently?
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That was one of the things that she took with her to the grave. She wouldn't speak about it.
Oh, my.
And so, yeah, you know, there's some struggles and some things that I still deal with to this day, and it helps me engage with people, you know, from different backgrounds, different places, and we're able to talk and have that commonality between us.
Sure. Well, let's talk about other things in your youth. I mean, Obviously the hunger is a big issue, but hunger then that was, didn't leave much time for schoolwork, I'm guessing.
No, I was, and I always tell people education is so important, but I didn't really pick up for education until much later in life.
Did you graduate high school?
I did. I actually graduated.
How did you graduate high school in that circumstance?
Well, so from, I would say, as far back as I can remember, is about 5 and 6. Up until I was 13, I was moving around with my biological mother, and it was me and my middle brother, and then she had the baby boy sometime there later. At 13, I got the opportunity to leave that environment, and, mm-hmm. and it was so many things. It's so many layers to my story. But before we get there, I want to talk about the molestation portion.
Oh, please do. Yes. Let's not skip that.
Yeah, it's really important. So one of the things that happened was with my mother being addicted to drugs and different things, she would have different people, and everybody in the community at that time was either an aunt or a cousin or those types of things. Well, one of my cousins touched me inappropriately, and I didn't know that it was molestation at the time. I just knew that something had happened and it wasn't right.
How old were you?
I was 6. And so I told my mother when she came home, you know, that it had happened. And her and her friend, which we called aunt, she called her over to the house and said, this is what your son did to my son. And they started punching him and kicking him, and they dragged him out of the house into the front yard, and they beat him out there. And so as a kid, I didn't really understand the gravity of what had taken place. All I know is that I had told, and now I see what had happened to him. And so I felt bad for that.
Before we go on, how old was your cousin?
He was 13, I believe, at the time.
Okay, so they take a 13-year-old boy who has done this thing to you, mm-hmm. and the story that you often hear is that nothing gets done.
Yeah.
Right? And what we're hearing here is the opposite. They take this boy out and drag him into the yard and beat him in front of you.
Yep. I wish I could say that that was the end of it,
mm-hmm.
but as a result of the alcoholism and the partying and stuff, there came another opportunity where I was left with him, and it went from inappropriate touching to sodomization at that point.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
And so when the next incident happened, he told me that if I said anything, he would kill me.
Oh, man.
And so that was the beginning of...
How old were you at that point?
We were still six.
Six.
It was only maybe a couple of months after the first incident that the second incident happened. Mm-hmm. And that's when I learned that I really didn't have anyone there to protect me and that I better keep my mouth shut if I wanted to be okay. And so I kept it within myself. And so as time moves on, it went from him where as I got older, I would start to fight back to another one of my mother's friend's husbands. And one of the things that happened during that time, and I'm probably around eight at this point or nine, mm-hmm. Is that he's telling me that if you don't do what I tell you to do, I'm not going to fight you anymore. Then your brother's I'm going to do this to your brother, basically.
Oh, boy.
So I learned in that moment how to, it was almost like when I was having these experiences that I would just, I would have an out-of-body experience. I would kind of leave and just let it happen and then move on as if, so as a kid, I'm dealing with all of these issues and I'm not talking about it. And so I just kind of, it's like day by day, just trying to struggle to make it. And so, you know, I didn't have clean clothes, a lot of bullying, just a lot of issues.
Did you get bullied at school too?
Bullied at school because my clothes stank. I would sleep in class. I would try to be the class clown at times to get some of the attention off of me. Meanwhile, dealing with all these things, knowing what's going to happen when I go home.
You're listening to Your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and today my guest is Deontay Diggs, a sheriff's deputy from Stafford County, Virginia. I met him recently at Montpelier, and I was impressed immediately by his sunny disposition, his positive outlook on life. But his story is deeper than that. His story is one of great tragedy and great difficulty as a youth, and we've been hearing a little bit about that just now. After the break, we'll come back and finish our discussion with Deontay Diggs, and I promise you we'll try to end on a happy note. Listening to Your Weekly Constitutional, I'm Stuart Harris, and now it's time to finish our discussion with Sheriff's Deputy Deontay Diggs, whom I met recently at Montpelier when I was teaching a seminar on the Fourth Amendment. Deontay is known as the Dancing Deputy because of the viral videos of him dancing in front of school groups and other groups and ending each of his videos with the splits. Remarkable fellow, remarkably sunny disposition. But we've been hearing about his very deprived, very difficult, and even abusive youth and how he overcame it. It turns out that he was helped by members of another helping profession, his teachers.
Yeah, and I have to say that I'm very thankful for, during that time in my life, for the teachers.
Did they step up and protect you?
Teachers, they didn't know what was going on, but they did everything that they could to make sure. Sometimes they would, you know, I would get the teacher, wake up, you need to pay attention. But it was like all of my teachers at that time had some sense that something wasn't right. Mm-hmm. And so they did what they could. And just a smile sometimes, just a hug or, you know, those types of things helped me to get through moments. And they didn't even realize what they were doing for me because I couldn't tell because I didn't want to break my family apart. I didn't want to leave my family. And it's interesting being here. We talked about that on the tour about how some of the slaves would come back here to be with their families, or that's the thought process. Why would you, being maybe in Philadelphia where you could be free, why would you come back here?
You're referring, of course, to the fact that Montpelier is very upfront about the slave issue.
Yes.
And that they've been rebuilding the slave quarters, and that you all had a tour today. And that's a dynamic that's often overlooked, is that some people escaped or had the opportunity to, but they would come back because it's their family and they love their family and they don't want to leave their family behind. So you were trapped similarly.
Yeah, definitely. And so as we move past it, there were three different men who molested me as a child.
Three? I've heard of three. Two. Who was the third? Two.
So the third was, and this is interesting because I know now what the facts actually are. But at the time, I looked at the third gentleman. We're staying in a trailer park.
Please, gentleman?
Yeah, well, I say gentleman.
Okay, the third fellow.
The third fellow. I thought it was a police officer, but in reality, it was a security.
Okay.
Security.
He was wearing a uniform, right?
He was wearing a uniform. and he stayed in the trailer across from us. And so a lot of times when these things were going on, my middle brother would be in the vicinity, sometimes laying feet away from me, and I would think that he was sleeping. And so this takes us right into the point where life changes for me at 13. So as I said earlier, I did it to protect him. I wanted to make sure that he was okay and he was safe.
This was your next youngest brother.
This is my middle brother.
Right, your middle brother.
Middle brother. And so there's a lot of pain going on there. And before I get to the big moment of change, I attempted suicide when I was 11 years old. I just had enough. There was no light at the end of the tunnel.
Yeah. You said you attempted suicide, and I don't mean to pry too deeply, but what did you do? What did you try to do?
So the night before, I went into the kitchen and I took a butcher knife. Where I planned to do it the next morning because I knew my mother would be passed out drunk. Usually by midday, it was on a weekend, my middle brother is gone and he's out. And the house, the place we were staying, there wouldn't be anyone there to stop me. And so when you look at suicide, they say that sometimes there are people that will not give you any clues. And I was that kid that, you know, I just had a smile no matter what was going on. People didn't know that I was hurting on the inside. Very private, because I didn't want to appear weak. Mm-hmm. And so I'm sitting on the bed the next morning, and I've determined that I'm going to cut my wrist. And the door behind me swings open. And in comes my baby brother, and he crawls up on the bed, and he comes over, he puts his arms around me, and I break down and I start crying. And it was like the light shone so bright at the end of the tunnel. And my reason for living at that moment was for my brothers. I was like, if I leave, who is going to be here to protect them? And so I made a promise to myself at that time. Number one, I would never try to hurt myself again, but also that I was going to be there for my brothers.
Well, that's dramatic. Your brother comes in like that. That must have been quite a moment.
You know, it really was, and it's the defining moment for me because it gave me my purpose in life. The only reason that I'm still here is because I didn't focus on self. I focused on others. And in focusing on others, it helped me to deal with the pain and the misery and stuff that I've experienced. And so 2 years later, I'm just so thankful and blessed in this, because 2 years later, I get the opportunity to leave it all behind. Now, I made that promise that I would never leave my brothers behind, but there was an incident where my brother was going into a gang, and that was his thing. My brother and I, similar experiences, but we chose different paths in life. And he always wanted to sell drugs, do drugs, be in the gang lifestyle. And as the oldest, I was always fighting my middle brother to stop and to do the right thing. I wasn't a saint, but I knew that those were things that were going to lead to nowhere. And I wanted to be better than my environment. Well, I come upon him and he was given a choice. It was either he was going to fight with me or he was going to join them and help beat me up. And he chose the gang over me. And so,
the gang basically said that to him.
Yeah.
If you want to be one of us, you have to beat up your older brother.
Mm-hmm. And so that was a breaking moment, and that was the defining moment.
He did it. He helped the gang beat you up.
He did.
Was that just some sort of test for him, or was it there was some beef that the gang had with you?
I don't think that was their initial plan. I think because I ruined, it was going to be a jump-in for him.
But a jump-in.
In order to be a part of that gang, you had to be beat up.
That was the initiation,
right?
That
was the initiation. And so when I messed that up, he was given the decision.
Oh, I see. You prevented him from doing that.
Yes, because I didn't know that was what was going on.
Now I see. And so they said, okay, well, now the initiation is we're going to go beat on your brother.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
And so in that moment, up to that point, I would, as I said before, I would go to church, and it really didn't matter the denomination because it was a place that I was going to be safe, and it was going to be a place that I could eat most of the time. And so I was at a camp, a Bible camp, and I didn't show up for the last day because this happened, say, on a Thursday, and the last day was that Friday, so I'm all bruised and stuff, and I didn't show up. And the leader shows up, and he says, if you can leave all of this behind, would you? And I said, absolutely. I said, you know, in that moment, in the pain, in the disgust of all of it, I said, I'm out of here. I want to do better. And so my mother, knowing them less than 5 minutes, wrote a note and signed me away to them. And these are strangers mind you, I leave with them from the Eastern Shore of Maryland, and I go to North Carolina.
Good heavens.
And so I go from a predominantly black environment, low income, drugs, and that type of environment, to now a predominantly middle class white environment. And so there were so many changes there. One of the things, and you heard me refer to the guys that molested me as gentlemen, and people, even when I do motivational speaking, they get shocked when I say that. And they're like, how can you say something like that? And it took me a long time to deal with the anger, the frustration, the betrayal, and all of those types of things that I experienced as a child. And one of the things that I started realizing, if I was going to be successful in this newfound freedom, this newfound family and love and life, was that I had to let go of all of that. I couldn't walk around bitter. I couldn't walk around angry at the world, because the world really didn't care. It was my job to acknowledge what had happened and move past it. And this is my opportunity, and I recognized it. And so I'm in this new environment now, and it was exciting. It was so exciting, but it was a lot of things that were challenged. So now I'm dealing with racism, okay? There are people in the community who are black, who are offended that I'm living with white people. So there was all those types of things. And so yeah, I get to talk about those things as well. I get there and I'm so far behind because, you know, I didn't have a really solid foundation in education. And so I start studying. I had to be the most focused person in the room.
What age were you at this point?
I'm 13.
13 years old, okay.
13.
So 8th grade or thereabouts?
When I got there, I was going, it's in the summertime, so I was going to my freshman year of high school.
That's a bad time to be way behind.
Yes, yes. And so I never thought that I was smart enough to go to college. My dream was only to ever graduate high school and maybe go into the military, because I knew that I was physically fit and I could mm-hmm. do that.
Well, finally someone was feeding you.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. And it was for the first time, the family that I went to live with, they said, don't worry about food, don't worry about bills, don't worry about shelter. We just want you to learn to be a kid. And so that was all new to me. I had no idea what that, you know, that felt like. I'd never been to a Walmart before. I didn't know what a pool was. You know, there was just so many new experiences that I had with them. And so we navigate, and I get to the point where I catch up. You know, I learned what a verb is, I learned what a noun is, and those types of things. And so I'm focused on the military, and my family at the time said, no, the military is not for you. We want you to go to college. Well, I don't feel like I'm smart enough to go to college. I can't afford to go to college. And they're like, you don't worry about that. However, you're still focused on military. They knew what really motivated me was money. So they said, you go to military school, you become an officer, you're going to make a lot of money. I said, sign me up. Where's the school at? And it just so happened that my foster brother or their son.
We've been speaking about your family. These people are obviously doing some pretty good things. Let's give them a shout out. Who are these people? What religious group are they with?
They are Southern Baptists. And I always say this, without them, I wouldn't be where I am today. Unfortunately, they don't like to be... They don't want their names out
there.
That's
perfectly okay. Just wanted to make sure we acknowledge them. These are good people.
Very, very good people. They took me in, and they had a son. And one of the things that I dealt with when I was living with them is the molestation and things that I experienced. Even at such a young age, I was aware that there was a belief out there that since I had been molested, that I would turn around or potentially do that to their son. And I knew in my heart that I would never do that. But I refused to talk to counselors or anybody else about it, because I felt like at any moment, if I did anything wrong, that they would potentially send me back or if they had any fear. And so I kept a lot of that on the inside. But their son, who was the same age as my baby brother, so he kind of filled that void. His baseball coach went to VMI, the Virginia Military Institute, mm-hmm. and he said, you know, he knew a little bit about my story, and he said, take the SAT, take the ACT, see where you come out, and let's see if we can't get you into VMI.
Which is a public institution.
It is. I applied, and I was accepted. And so I get there, and the military stuff comes easy to me. So I said, but the academics were hard. And so I found a lot of the time in the beginning I was focusing on the military stuff and not so much on the academics. And this is where the relationship with my family starts to break down. And this is
your adoptive family.
Because I started dealing with things on the inside, realizing that I was attracted to men.
I just have to interrupt you here.
Yes.
Now, there's nothing wrong with being gay, but for heaven's sake, it's a challenge. Hadn't you had enough challenges at that point?
I'm telling you, it was. And one of the things at VMI that they talk about is integrity and honesty.
Right.
And so I'm starting to struggle because I don't want to lie about who I'm going to see or who I'm having a date with. And so I decided in that moment that I had to live in my authenticity,
mm-hmm.
and that I had to come out. And I didn't know what that was going to look like. But I started with my family. And when I told my family, the long story short was they disowned me.
Oh, I'm so sorry. These are the people who had done such good things for you up
definitely.
To this point. And I'm guessing it was a religious issue?
It was.
Oh,
it
I'm
was.
So sorry. Are you still estranged?
We aren't. It's taken some time to build that relationship. And that's part of why they don't like to be mentioned.
I'm so glad to hear that you've reconciled with them.
It's been hard. It's
uh-huh.
been really hard. We go in and out of our relationship due to, you know, gay marriage and those types of things. But I've always, and I do this with everyone that I come into contact with, whether we disagree or not, I leave the door open. And if you want to walk through and meet me, and we can, we do that. So I understand. And one of the things that when I talk to LGBT youth is, I tell them it was a long journey for me to finally love myself and respect myself. I had a hard time because of my religious background and upbringings to accept myself. And so if it took me a while to accept myself and love myself, then I realize and understand that may be the same for my family and other people out there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I give them some wiggle room, so to speak. And so we've had a tumultuous relationship, so to speak.
Yeah, I guess.
But it's working itself out.
This all happened about 10 years ago, because you're about 30 now, right?
Mm-hmm.
30, 31?
31.
31 now. So this is about 10 years ago, and you're in college. This all happened. Had you had any hint that you were gay before you went off to VMI? I mean, had you even thought about it?
I don't think that I really had the time to really think about it. There was so much that I was dealing with on the inside, and so many things. And like I said, there's so many layers. I mean, I could speak for hours about
this stuff.
And different things that happened. But I think I came to terms with it at, if I'm completely honest, I say maybe my senior year, there was some time in there during the summer. Maybe I was like, oh, but I didn't really think about that. At VMI, I had my challenges, and that was really where I started to embrace myself, because the core kind of ostracized me for the first year. Nobody wanted anything to do with me. And so my thing
was... You're poor, you're black, and you're gay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Can't think of much worse,
you could have been female or transgender, I guess, was the only categories I'm thinking that you couldn't check off on a list of things that might cause people to discriminate against you. And so this was perhaps not the most accepting environment when you were there.
No. And that's the thing that people, when they get to meet me or they look at me and they say, how do you do it? Because I'm able to go into these, what some would term as ultra conservative environments, or we'll just say environments where people don't necessarily agree with maybe my lifestyle
mm-hmm.
Or some of the things that I do, but I'm able to still have a relationship with them and bridge that gap. The thing is that, you know, I have empathy and compassion for all people, regardless of your stance, your political stance, where you come from, your beliefs. I just love people. And it stems back from, you know, the incident that I had where I attempted suicide, really finding out at such a young age what I'm meant to be here for, what I do. And so it transitioned, and I ended up graduating from VMI, rebuilding a relationship with my biological family and, mm-hmm. and my mother. We kind of started that while I was at VMI.
How are your brothers doing?
And, well, my younger brother is doing very well.
The youngest.
The youngest.
The baby.
Mm-hmm. The middle brother, he isn't doing too well.
I'm sorry.
He eventually became schizophrenic due to drugs.
Mm.
He has some mental health issues. And, my goal now is to, sometime in the near future, hopefully bring him to Fredericksburg, Virginia, where I stay, and help him through that and make sure that he has the right treatment and the right care.
This is the brother who beat you down.
Yes.
That's very forgiving of you. And Deontay, I hate to say this, we're running short on time. You mentioned time a moment ago, and I could sit here for days with you and hear all your stories, but the tyranny of the clock is telling me we have to finish up. It brings us back to the beginning. This dancing you were doing that mm-hmm. has brought you so much attention was simply part of your outreach. You
Definitely.
Obviously you have a job to do, a police job that you do.
Yeah.
But you go out and you speak at churches. You were telling me about this. Very conservative churches sometimes. You share your experiences as a gay man, as a man who's endured abuse, as a black man who's risen from great poverty. And I must say, it's simply a remarkable attitude that you have, and one I think that we can all admire.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate that. And like you said, I find that I've always been placed by God in the right place at the right time. And now being in law enforcement, I'm able to go into the communities and bridge the gap between law enforcement and the community. And I'm able to see it from both sides. And so dancing is just a part of the way that I do that.
It's only part of the way because I know you do something else. Because when I met you today, you were doing something else. You were singing.
Yes, I do that for the sheriff's office as well.
And you picked up on a song that I enjoy as well. So are you ready?
We're going to do it.
Now, remember, we got to go up high now. Okay. Ready? You start. 1, 2, 3.
Why do you fill me up, buttercup baby, just to let me down? I'm around and then worst of all, you never come, baby, when you say you will. But I need you still.
I need you.
I need you.
I need you.
More than anything, darling.
Ready? You know that I have from the start. So build me up, buttercup. Don't break my heart. Well done. Thanks very much, Deontay Diggs. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Thank you. Again, but you're late. I wait around and then.
That's our show. Thanks very much to my new buddy, Deontay Diggs, a deputy sheriff in the Stafford County, Virginia Sheriff's Department. What a great guy. What an inspiring story. Executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by the Fifes and Drums of Colonial Williamsburg, and today a little bit by Beyonce and by the Foundations, who did Build Me Up, Buttercup. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment.